Well, let me begin by giving honor to whom honor is due and thanking Yahweh Yeshua for giving me the privilege, joy, and opportunity to be here with you at this conference. I would like to thank Ben and Alan and all and everyone on your team who's worked so hard to put this conference together, and thank you for inviting me. And I've been blessed, and I pray that you've been blessed as well. This is going to be part four of my series that I'm sharing with you at this conference. And ultimately, what I've tried to do is, the first couple messages, is that I tried to lay a foundation for you, especially for those of you who may be newer, because we always have new people that's coming in our midst and seeking to understand Torah and Two House. I try to lay a foundation for you, and then here the last couple messages, I'm trying to show you why it's important and significant for you to understand and embrace Torah and the Two Houses, because it has everything to do with being prepared for Messiah's second coming, which I believe, and I've been trying to give evidence from the scriptures and from what is actually happening in the real world in which we live, that the time is very, very near. And if I can give you a 5-minute overview of the Bible, this is going to be my effort now. Yahweh created the heavens and the earth for the sake of Israel, entering in a covenant with Israel, and that he would have a people who he would give his Torah to, that would be called upon to follow the Torah and to glorify their Creator. That's the purpose of the earth, and the purpose of you and I being here is to find our purpose, find our Creator, and to participate in that plan. Ultimately, that covenant was made at Mount Sinai. While it was the Father who wrote it, it is the Messiah who actually made that covenant and was the lawgiver. And the Messiah also entered into marriage with the nation of Israel, called the House of Jacob, there at Mount Sinai. But the Bible records that the House of Jacob was unfaithful, and because of that, the punishment was exile into the nations of the world. The book of Daniel gives us an outline of Gentile world powers that would rule on the earth and rule over the nation of Israel while they are in exile. However, there comes a point in time when Gentile rule over the nations ends, and that has got to coincide with the end of the exile. What period of time does Gentile rule end and the exiles are gathered, Messiah is glorified so that he can rule and reign with Israel at the head? That transition is called the tribulation. And a term for the messianic times in the Bible, it's called the Day of Yahweh. Yeshua is Yahweh. It's His day. It's the day that the Messiah is revealed to the world and glorified. We have a whole book of the Bible written to tell us about it. It's called the Revelation, which means He's not fully revealed and not fully glorified in the earth. Now, so that we would know when that time comes, we are given events that happen in that transition period, known as the Day of Yahweh. And the Day of Yahweh, which is Messianic times, the Messianic era begins with the tribulation period and the darkness part of the tribulation period. So these events here that's being outlined happen during the darkness part of the Day of Yahweh. And so I have highlighted for you some of the events of the day of Yahweh. Among them, the gods that will be forsaken. It says in Zephaniah chapter 1, verses 14 and 15, it's the day of Yahweh. Zephaniah chapter 2, verse 4, the gods that get forsaken. How do we interpret that? Well, one way that one might interpret that is that in August of 2005, Jews were kicked out of their homes in the Gaza. And so therefore, that could be evidence that we are actually in the tribulation, that we are in the day of Yahweh. However, because the Bible gives other things that happens in the day of Yahweh, in order for me to really see that we are in the tribulation, I need to see the confirmation of other things in the day of Yahweh, looking for these things to happen. And if they happen as well, you come to your own conclusion, but I'm going to come to the conclusion that we are in the tribulation. And some of these other things are, I'm going to mention one that's not in here, because there is a possibility from the things that are actually going on in the world right now that this could happen not very far in the future, and that is that Damascus becomes a ruinous heap, and that is Isaiah in chapter 17. And it is, and it happens in the day of Yahweh. It says Isaiah 17:4, and in that day, and it says in verse 7, at that day. So that is a day of Yahweh event. In addition, the significant thing is the controversy over the land and the specific areas in the land that the focus of the controversy is upon happens to be the mountains of Israel, also called Judea and Samaria, the West Bank, and the city of Jerusalem. And there are far advanced plans at the moment to make the mountains of Israel and East Jerusalem into a PLO state. That is the official policy of the Bush administration and the official policy of the Israeli government as well. And as I mentioned earlier, in the past week, Bush has called an international peace conference, and it's supposed to be in September, is what the rumors are. And right now, unless they change their minds, they're supposed to have that meeting in New York, is the last that I heard. And so, if the outcome of those meetings happens to be a signed agreement for the establishment of a PLO state, I believe that that's going to the evidence that we actually are in the tribulation, but not the last 3.5 years. And as a result of dividing the land of Israel, it brings judgment upon the whole world, including the nation of Israel. And I want to focus in this session on the judgment that comes upon an entity known as Babylon. So it goes like this: dividing of the land brings about the judgment of the nations, and the judgment of the nations brings about the ingathering of the exiles. And we tried to teach you in this conference that when we're talking about the ingathering of the exiles, we're not just talking about them. We're talking about them and you. It brings about the ingathering of the exiles, and then Messiah is glorified through that event. He sets his feet down on the Mount of Olives, and he sets up his kingdom from Jerusalem, where Israel, redeemed, will rule and reign with him. The way in which this happens is a parallel. It is a parallel of the historical Egyptian redemption. So what happened in the historical Egyptian redemption? Moses goes to Pharaoh and says, "Let my people go," and Pharaoh says no. What that means is, when it is biblical time for the exiles to return home, the world won't allow it. The United States government won't allow it. the Israeli government won't allow it. There will be great opposition. It was through that opposition that Pharaoh had that Yahweh revealed and showed his power and majesty to Egypt, to the known world at that time, and also to his people. And so it's through the judgments that come upon the earth is how Yeshua the Messiah is going to be glorified and reveal himself as well. And the Bible says that the miracles of the return of the exiles so far exceed the miracles of the Exodus that when you talk about Passover and celebrating the Exodus, you're not talking about the one in Egypt because that was like too small of an event. You're talking about the one that happened in the end of the day. So we're talking about something on a very large scale, and it's the rule of 144,000 to lead the return back to the land. So I'm going to try to cover some details of this as much as I can in my remaining session, and I believe I have an hour and 15 minutes to do it. So here in Zephaniah chapter 1, verses 14 and 15, the context is the day of Yahweh, and in Zephaniah 2:4, Gaza is forsaken. Another way of looking at the Gaza being forsaken is that because Hamas defeated Fatah in the Gaza, and basically their government headquarters at the moment is in the Gaza, the international community won't recognize Hamas, so they're being forsaken. The Gaza is being forsaken. Here in Joel chapter 1, verse 15, the context is the day of Yahweh. And in Joel chapter 3, verse 2, all the nations are going to be gathered, and they're going to part or divide his land. Zechariah 14, verse 1, it is the day of Yahweh. Verse 2, all nations are gathered against Jerusalem, and half the city goes into captivity. Captivity means the people of Yahweh who's living in the city get kicked out of the place. In other words, any Jews that live in East Jerusalem will be asked to no longer live in East Jerusalem. And that brings about judgment. Then Yahweh will go forth and fight against the nations as he fought in the day of battle. The day of battle is interpreted as the day, Exodus chapter 15, when Pharaoh and his army drowned in the sea. He's got to fight like in that day. If you read Zechariah 14, it goes on to say that the nations that come up against Jerusalem that divide the city, the judgment will be nuclear warfare. And then after he fights against the nations, next verse, he'll set his seat down on the Mount of Olives. Here in Zechariah 14:12, this is the plague. Remember Egypt had plagues upon it? This is the plague where Yahweh will smite all the people that fight against Jerusalem. Their flesh will consume away while they stand upon their feet. Their eyes shall consume away in their holes, and their tongue shall consume away in their mouth. Now, the Bible says, he to as much is given, much is required. And basically, the nation that's making all of this possible to divide the land is the United States of America. They're leading the effort. Therefore, the greatest judgment that will come upon any nation of the earth is the United States of America. Why would Yahweh do that? Because where is the greatest number of Jews and Christians that live in the world? What country? The United States. And if the exiles have got to return home, somehow he's got to get them to leave the United States. Well, you know, the United States is regarded as the best country on the earth to live. And so why would people who live in the best country on the earth want to leave the country? Yahweh has to do something to make you think that it's not worth living here anymore. And that's why the judgment is coming. So you'll get uncomfortable and think about what you need to do. And biblically, you're supposed to leave and return to the land. Now, Jeremiah 30, verse 7 talks about Jacob's trouble. And in speaking about Jacob's trouble, which is the tribulation, in verse 11, in the context of Jacob's trouble, it says, I'm going to save you, Israel, though I make a full end of all nations where I scattered you. So as he's saving the exiles, he's judging the nations. And Isaiah 34, verse 1, come near, you nations, for the indignation of Yahweh is upon the nations. Why is he so mad with the nations? Verse 8, because of the controversy of Zion. It's over the controversy of Zion that he judges the nations, and this is in the day of his vengeance. When is the day of his vengeance? The tribulation. Why is he so mad for? Why does he want to take vengeance? Because they divided his land. Well, why is he so upset at dividing his land? Because it is an assault on the integrity of his name. Because in Genesis 22, Yahweh swore by himself to Abraham and a promise to his seed that I've given you the land. And this taking of the land and making Jerusalem an international city is a coup and an assault against Yahweh, his land, and Jerusalem, the city that he loves, which we saw in the last presentation, the importance of Jerusalem to Yahweh. He's placed his name there. He's written the Hebrew letter Shin upon the physical layout of the city. And so, what are we told that Hasatan wanted to do? I will ascend my throne above Yahweh's throne in the sides of the north. He wanted to take Jerusalem. So in the earth, when the world seeks to take Jerusalem, that's when the wrath of Yahweh comes. Now, it's in the day of Yahweh, in the judgment of the nations, that Babylon falls. Isaiah 13, verse 6, "How ye, for the day of Yahweh is at hand. And in the day of Yahweh, Babylon, the glory of kingdoms." Well, what nation on the earth is regarded as the best nation to live on the earth? The glory of kingdoms. It's the United States of America. So somehow in the end of days, the glory of kingdoms gets judged. I'd like to submit to you that present-day Iraq is not the glory of the nations that live on the earth today. And in Isaiah chapter 13, in verse 17, we see what is the trigger that causes Babylon to fall. It says, "I will stir up the Medes against them." I will stir up the Medes against them. That is repeated in Jeremiah chapter 51, verse 11 and verse 28. He will stir up the Medes against them. Historically, how did Babylon fall? Through the Medes. In the end of days, how does Babylon fall? Through the Medes. Who are the Medes? The Iranians. It is no coincidence that at the very moment we're talking about dividing the land of Israel, that is creating a PLO state, no coincidence at the same time we are wanting to do something with Iran and their nuclear capabilities that they are building. Now, if Babylon gets destroyed, we need to understand what Babylon is. Babylon is, or Babel, is the Strong's number 894 in the Hebrew dictionary. And what it means is confusion by mixing is the definition of Babylon. Confusion by mixing. You remember Brad Scott's presentation on the wheat and the tares? What was it all about? Someone came and mixed something in with the seed. There was a mixing. And mixing causes confusion. You know why there's so much confusion in Christianity about understanding what the Bible says? Because there's so much mixture. And the mixture causes confusion. If you go to someone and say, you know, Sunday comes from Constantine, and it comes from the religion of Mithraism in the Roman Empire, and the birthday of the goddess Mithras was December 25th, and this is not what Yahweh commanded us to do, the people's response is, "But I'm not doing it like that. I'm doing it for good purposes. Out of my heart, I'm really honoring Yeshua's birthday." And so because they rightly believe that he's the Messiah, they tolerate mixture. And the confusion comes in through the mixture. That is the meaning of Babylon. Now, in talking about Babylon, it's a generic term that means anything that opposes Yahweh. Anything that's anti-Torah is Babylon. Anything that opposes Yeshua is Babylon. But Babylon is broken down into different units. There's a historical, physical land of Babylon. And here I have a map for you of the historical Babylonian Empire. There's a financial Babylon. The monetary system in our world is not a Torah-based monetary system. It's financial Babylon. So when Babylon falls, that means, among other things, you are going to have an economic collapse in the United States and an economic collapse in the world, because it's the fall of Babylon. There is a religious Babylon, and there's an effort to bring about one world religion, to unite the religions of the world, and to say, you know, no religion's any better than any other religion. They all have something to add. They all believe in a supreme deity, and so they're all okay. This is religious Babylon, and that system is going to fall as well. But I'm going to focus on an end-time spiritual land of Babylon that's got to get judged for dividing the land of Israel. And I'd like to submit to you, and I'm going to give you characteristics, that this spiritual land of Babylon is the United States of America. Let's look at the characteristics to see from Scripture if we can identify that this is referring to the United States of America. And we're going to focus on Jeremiah chapter 50 and 51. But Babylon falling is in Isaiah 13, Isaiah 21, Isaiah 47, Jeremiah 50, 51, Revelation 18. And if you read Revelation 18 and you got a Bible that's got a cross-reference, read what it says in Revelation 18. All what it's doing, it's quoting from the prophets. Most of Revelation 18 is just quoting from the prophets. Back to Isaiah 13, back to Jeremiah 50, 51. So in Genesis 49:1, it says, Jacob called unto his sons and said, gather yourselves together, that I may tell you what will befall you in the last days. The word last, this is Strong's number 319, it's the Hebrew word akarit, and here's the definition in this Strong's, it means the end or the latter time. The hindermost, the last. So in Jeremiah 50 verse 12, about Babylon, it says, your mother shall be sore confounded, she that bare you shall be ashamed. Behold, the akarit of the nations, the end of the nations, the latter time nation, the hindermost of the nations, the last of the nations. In other words, it's an end time nation. Jeremiah 50 verse 37 says, a sword is upon her treasures. It means that she's economically prosperous. Jeremiah 51 verse 13, she's abundant in treasures. But notice, a sword is upon it. What's one of the symbols of Islam? A sword. And what are they telling us? You know, we don't know exactly when it's going to happen, but it's inevitable that we're going to get another attack, and it's probably going to be from the Islamic world, or influenced by the Islamic world. Jeremiah 51 verse 53, though Babylon should mount up to heaven, it means she's a military power, and she fortifies the heights of her strength, yet for me shall spoilers come unto her. So here's a map of the U.S. military bases from the years 2001 to 2003, and those areas in red is where the United States has our military presence, and we have a military presence in over 730 military installations and bases in over 50 countries. That's a world military power. Babylon has defeated mighty kingdoms through war. Jeremiah 51 verse 20. You are my battle axe and weapons of war. For with you, with Babylon, will I break in nations, break in pieces the nations, and with you I will destroy kingdoms. The United States was a part of being victorious in World War I and World War II. Jeremiah 51 verse 13, O you that dwell upon many waters, the United States is surrounded by bodies of water, the Atlantic Ocean to the east, the Pacific Ocean to the west, the Gulf of Mexico to the south, the Great Lakes in the Midwest, the mighty Mississippi, and other rivers in the country. The state of Minnesota itself is called the land of 10,000 lakes. Babylon is a melting pot of nations. Jeremiah 50 verse 37. A sword is upon the mingled people. Mingled people. And by the way, what's one of the big issues of controversy right now politically? It is immigration. And you know, the nation of Israel often had a struggle with the Philistines. And you know what the word Philistine means? It means an immigrant. So Israel having a battle with the Philistines is having a battle with immigrants. Well, over in the land of Israel, it's the PLO. Here, we're battling the issue of immigration. Isaiah 47 verse 5, it says Babylon is the Lady of Kingdoms, the supreme entity. And Isaiah 47:8, Babylon thinks and says of herself, I will not sit as a widow. In other words, nothing's going to happen to me. I'm not concerned that nothing's going to happen to me. I will not sit as a widow, neither shall I know the loss of children or the loss of life. Now, because it says of Babylon, she will not sit as a widow, a widow would be a woman. Now, if you apply this literally, a Babylon characterized by a woman, one could interpret the possibility that it might be that the last president of the United States is going to be a woman. Because Babylon says, I will not be a widow. Jeremiah 50, verse 32, it says, a fire is kindled in the cities of Babylon. So you know where you don't want to be? In and around big cities. And Jeremiah 50 verse 9, Babylon is destroyed by an assembly of nations. And it says, their arrows shall be as a mighty expert man. None will return in vain. You know what those arrows are? ICBM missiles. And who's the assembly of nations that is currently working together against America? Russia, China, Iran, Syria, Hezbollah, Hamas, Venezuela, North Korea. They are all working together against the United States of America. It says in Jeremiah 50 verse 14, shoot at her and spare no arrows. In other words, when the attack comes, it's going to be devastating. And Jeremiah 50 verse 40, as Elohim overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. Well, how did he overthrow Sodom and Gomorrah? Fire from heaven. Well, what's today's fire? ICBM. Jeremiah 51 verse 29, it says, and I believe this is literal, it says, the land of Babylon will be a desolation without an inhabitant. I believe that's literal. At the end of the tribulation, there will not able to be one person living in Babylon, or spiritual Babylon, the United States of America. It won't fall all at once that way. Because Babylon is fallen. It's in stages. The final stage is no inhabitant. Yahweh is going to give us an opportunity to get out of here before this place is not livable. And so, basically, your choice becomes you're either going to do the will of Yahweh and go to the land, or you're going to stay here and die. And it's your choice. Jeremiah 50, verse 46. It does look like Brad, doesn't it? It says, the world is astonished at the fall of Babylon. At the noise of the taking of Babylon, the earth is moved and a cry is heard among the nations. It will panic the world. Why will it panic the world? Because it will cause Wall Street to collapse. It will cause the dollar to collapse, and because oil is traded in dollars, and dollars the reserve currency, it will collapse the economy of the world. The world will be moved. But how is the world going to try to recover from this devastating event? They will set up one world government and one currency. And when they do, the international world will be reassured, because now we have something that has replaced, that it's not tied to one country, and that country's currency. Jeremiah 50 verse 11, it says, "You destroyers of my heritage." This can be interpreted several ways. The Bible says children are the heritage of Yahweh. So children are being killed in Babylon. And this is happening through abortion. But his heritage is his Torah. And so this country was founded on Judeo-Christian principles, which has been eroded. Do you realize that in the early days of this country, I'm old enough to remember. Remember the old, I think it was called the McGuffey Readers or something like that? You know, in the early days of this country, in the colonies, everyone that went to public school, they learned to read from the Bible. And now they say that's unconstitutional. Well, the people who were doing that was closer to the Constitution than the people now. So how is it unconstitutional? And Jeremiah 50 verse 16 says, "Cut off the sower from Babylon in the time of harvest." Yeshua said the harvest is at the end of the ages. So Babylon, the sower of Babylon gets cut off in the end of the ages. And who is the sower? Remember, God shared with you the parable of the sower? The sower sows the word. So the word is being cut off from Babylon in the time of the harvest. And I was just thinking that if we are as close as what I believe we might possibly be, and if you heard my first message when we started the conference, I started out by saying I'm concerned that we are so close to these things happening that those who haven't gotten the message yet are in danger of being foolish virgins. And I've been working since January of 2005 to formally put together an 18-month discipleship program to take someone's hand and to walk them through with slides, topic by topic, like you're seeing, to learn the Hebrew roots. I thought that would be a very powerful thing to do. But if we are as close as what I think we might be, which we should know in the next 9 months whether these things happen or not, or whether we still got a few more years, for the sake of getting the word out, I hope we have a few more years. But anyhow, I'm concerned that I won't even get my discipleship program done and getting it available because the sower is being cut off in the time of harvest, which is when he's gathering the exiles of Israel. And it says, Babylon refuses to repent. Babylon has suddenly fallen. Take balm for her. If so, be she may repent. I would have healed Babylon, but she is not healed. You know, after 9/11, did you think about this? 9/11 happened during the week, right? Do you realize on that weekend, Yahweh caused the entire nation to take Sabbath? There was no sporting events or anything. They closed them all down. Did you know that? And you know what happened to everybody? They was all in their places of worship. Everyone went to church. You know, they was getting serious. But you know what? And they was all singing, you know, instead of our national anthem, they was singing God Bless America. You know, guess what? They quit singing God Bless America now. And so we've actually gotten more wicked since 9/11 than what we were before. And so we haven't taken the warning. As a matter of fact, I believe both Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson, I believe, said that 9/11 was a judgment from Yahweh. And I believe that they were right. And you know, they were so mocked and ridiculed on the media that they were pretty much forced to take back their words. And in Jeremiah 50 verse 4, it says, "In those days and at that time," that's an idiom for the day of Yahweh. So So Babylon falls in the day of Yahweh, as it says explicitly in Isaiah 13, verse 6. In those days and at that time, in the day of Yahweh, the children of Israel and the children of Judah are going together seek Yahweh their Elohim. So there has to be an end time nation in the day of Yahweh that has the children of Israel and the children of Judah there. Well, there's hardly any Jews and Christians in Iraq. And the largest number of Jews and Christians are in the United States. So the children of Israel and the children of Judah will be going and weeping. That's repenting. And they will seek Yahweh the Elohim. That's Yeshua the Messiah. And then it goes on to say that they will ask the way to Zion. They're asking the way to Zion. You know, if you have to ask, you don't know it. In other words, you're going to say, what should we do? And do you realize what this conference has been about, what I've tried to show you in my messages, is we're showing you the way to Zion. And they're going to ask the way to Zion. And then it says in Jeremiah 50, verse 16, for fear of the oppressing sword, for fear for greater war in the land, everyone will flee to his own land. You know, for example, there's many Asians that live in California. Many of them are going to get so afraid about what is coming to the United States, what's happening in California, that they want to go back to Asia. But Yahweh's people, who's in covenant with him, are supposed to flee to our own land. That is the land of Israel. And now it says in Jeremiah 50, verse 50, you who have escaped the sword, let Jerusalem come to your mind. Which means the return is after the attack, because it's those who have escaped the attack. Remember, there's another verse that says there won't be an inhabitant. And so there's an initial attack where there's survivors, and they're supposed to let Jerusalem come to your mind, but then there's another period of time where an attack comes where there's not an inhabitant. That comes at the end of the Great Tribulation. Because it says in Revelation 18, in 1 hour, destruction comes. What is the way to Zion? I went over this in the last session. It's the unification of the people of Yahweh, Ephraim and Judah, who return to the land of Yahweh, who are following Torah, embracing the covenant made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and Messiah is their head. That is Zion. And it's the cry of the watchman to go to Zion. Jeremiah 31, verse 6. There shall be a day, and I like to submit to you that day is today. But the watchman, I'd like to submit to you that this is a watchman message, upon Mount Ephraim will say, arise. That means be awakened from spiritual slumber. Arise, and let us go to Zion unto Yahweh our Elohim. Now, how is all of this going to happen? You have the dividing of the land. And from the dividing of the land, those who want to stick to Torah, not be kicked out of the land, believe in the covenant that was made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and who is believing the Messiah to deliver them from these woes, that would be the religious Jews in the land, they are going to rebel when there is a PLO state that the current government of Israel signs a paper and says, that land belongs to the Palestinians. They're going to rebel. And when they rebel, they're going to take their mouths and they're going to declare an independent state. They're going to declare their independence from the present state of Israel. How was the United States formed? With the Declaration of Independence. It was formed through rebellion. Rebellion against England. So there's going to be a rebellion in Israel. Well, what happened to those who rebelled in the United States? They rebelled for the purpose of setting up a land, and they dedicated it to Yeshua. And that's what's going to happen in Israel. They're going to rebel, and they're going to declare a state, a Torah-based state. And they're going to ask the Messiah to come and return and to fight for them. And the Bible, I'm going to show you this later on in the message, that is the moment when the Bible says, I'm going to give you the scripture later on, that's the moment when the Bible says that the Messiah no longer hides his face, but he will roar. That's the moment when he begins to reveal himself to his people. Now, the way this is going to happen, you guys got the principle? The way it is going to happen is how it already did. I already showed you it's likened unto Egypt, but it's also likened unto the book of Daniel, which when Antiochus tried to impose Greek rule, there was a rebellion by a minority. They were known as the Maccabees. And against all odds, well, how long is the tribulation? I mean, the Great Tribulation? 3.5 years? How long was the Maccabee rebellion and victory? 3 years? Against all odds, Yahweh was with them, and they was able to defeat the Greeks and to dedicate the temple. And so the rebellion against the PLO state is likened to that rebellion against Antiochus. And here's the prophecy of it. Zechariah 9:13. When I have bent Judah for me and built and filled the bow with Ephraim. In other words, they have to be working together. You know why things continually get worse, and the situation continually gets worse, and the leaders don't see a real viable and practical and believable solution to the conflict? You know why Yahweh's allowing it to continue to deteriorate? Because Judah in the land is not even looking and considering who their brother Ephraim is, or consider inviting them to come home to the land. And so Yahweh's got to make things miserable until they're basically forced to invite their brother. Now there's animosity toward their brother because their brother believes that Yeshua is the Messiah. And so I'm going to raise up your sons of Zion. See, the sons of Zion is Ephraim and Judah, against the sons of Greece. The sons of Greece wants to impose Greek values. So the battle of the Great Tribulation is the sons of Greece against the sons of Zion. We call the sons of Greece the beast in the beast system. We'll fight the sons of Zion. That's Revelation chapter 12. Now, the enemies of Israel are called beasts of the field. And in Deuteronomy 7, verse 16, ye shall consume all the people which Yahweh your Elohim will deliver you, verse 22, and Yahweh your Elohim will put out those nations before you little by little, you may not consume them at once, lest the beasts of the field increase upon you. So the nations of the world that rule over the nation of Israel in their exile are called beasts of the field. That's why in the book of Daniel, the nations are described as being animals or beasts. Now, in Daniel's vision of the ram and the goat, which is the background of how the Greeks came to power to impose their will upon the Jewish people. We have here, beginning in Daniel chapter 8, this vision of the ram and the goats. And we're told that the ram is Media Persia. Daniel 8:20, the ram which you saw having two horns are the kings of Media and Persia. And this is a map of the Persian Empire, which is going to include Iran and Iraq of today. And then in Daniel chapter 8, verse 5, there was a goat, and it says in Daniel 8:21, the goat is Greece. So there's a battle between Media, Persia, and Greece. And the head of the Grecian Empire was one that history calls Alexander the Great. And Alexander tried to set up Greek culture and unify the world through this Greek culture with a common language. And we're told in Daniel chapter 8, verses 6 and 7, that Greece defeated the Media-Persian Empire. So here is a map of the height of the Grecian Empire, which included Egypt and the lower Mediterranean. And we have going into the eastern world across the Euphrates River. And Alexander died at a young age. He died at 32. And they ask you, what do we do with your kingdom? He said, whoever's strongest gets it. And so there was a fight between four of his generals, and the kingdom was divided between the four of his generals. And the two significant ones was those that controlled the north, which is the Seleucids. The Bible calls in Daniel the king of the north, the Seleucids. And then the Ptolemies of Egypt, which the Bible calls the king of the south. And they fought against each other for supremacy, and the nation of Israel, the land of Israel, became the battleground. Here is a coin that I have for you of Antiochus portrayed as Zeus. You know, there are those who say that Jesus is rendered from Hey Zeus. Well, this is a coin of Antiochus, and look at how Antiochus is portrayed. Doesn't it kind of somewhat resemble our pictures of Jesus? So Israel became the battleground between the Greek Seleucids and the Greek Ptolemies. And here I have a chart for you to show you when Antiochus was in power, who the Seleucid rulers is, and the ones who opposed them became known as the Maccabees. And Antiochus the Fourth waged war against the Jews, as we're told in Daniel chapter 8, verses 22 through 24. Now, some of the details of what Antiochus did is in the extra-biblical book known as 1st and 2nd Maccabees. 1st and 2nd Maccabees. And in 1st Maccabees chapter 1, verse 10, it says, Antiochus arose. He arose and he reigned in the 137th year of the kingdom of the Greeks. And it says he went up against Jerusalem and he entered proudly into the temple and he took away the golden altar, the candlestick of light, and all the vessels. And the table of showbread and the censers of gold. He took the precious vessels and he made a great massacre and he spoke very proudly. He is a foreshadowing of what we commonly call the Antichrist. In Daniel chapter 8, verse 25, it says, by peace he destroyed many. And this is also stated in 1 Maccabees chapter 1, verse 30. He spoke peaceable words, but they were all in deceit. And so this peace that's being spoken of in the Middle East with the Palestinians, Mahmoud Abbas is accepting peace thoughts, but it's deceit. President Bush is saying Mahmoud Abbas is a moderate. He wants peace. We have a genuine peace partner, but it's all deceit. Daniel chapter 8, verses 11 and 12. It says he magnified himself and he took away the daily sacrifice. And this is repeated in 1 Maccabees chapter 1, verse 54, 56, and 59. It says, in the 15th day of the month of Kislev, they set up the abomination of desolation, and in the 25th day of Kislev, they sacrificed an idol upon the altar. So they set up a statue of Zeus, and they sacrificed the most unclean of animals, that was a pig, on the altar. Do you realize that that is what the Bible calls the abomination of desolation? Setting up a statue of Zeus and sacrificing a pig on the altar, the book of Daniel calls the abomination of desolation, and we think it's okay to eat pig in our bodies in our altar. And the Daniel calls it abomination of desolation. Now, it's that event that Yeshua is referring to in Matthew 24, verse 15, and it says, when you see in the future the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel. Well, Daniel spoke of what literally happened, but Messiah is talking about what will happen. Why? Because what did happen is a prophetic foreshadowing of what will happen. So in the future, there will be abomination of desolation. So Yeshua said, when you see it in the future, those who are in Judea, flee to the mountains. What happened historically? What happened historically is Mattathias and his five sons, 1 Maccabees chapter 2, verses 1 and 2. Verse 6, when he saw the blasphemies that was committed in Judea and Jerusalem. Verse 28, he and his sons fled into the mountains. What Yeshua said to do was already done by the Maccabees. Now, in order to understand what Antiochus was doing and the statement he was making, we have to understand Zeus in Greek mythology. Zeus is personified as an eagle, and Zeus represents the god of all gods. And Zeus appears as the image of appeasement, order, wisdom, and justice. Let me repeat that. Zeus appears as the image of appeasement, order, wisdom, and justice. What the United States is trying to do in the world, you know what they're appearing as? They want to bring peace and order, and they're trying to operate with wisdom and logic, and the people saying, yeah, you know what we're doing. Yeah, we need to solve the problem in the Middle East. Yeah, we need peace. Yeah, we need to go against Iran. This is all and good. But if you really know, and not very many people really know, why we actually are in Iraq, and I don't have time to explain it to you, the real reason why we're in Iraq is not to make you safer in Portland, Oregon. Because you know what? We have 250,000 troops in Iraq. We have 250,000 troops in Iraq that's supposed to be making us safer in Portland, Oregon. Now, if they really wanted to make me safer in Portland, Oregon, you know what they would do? They would take 250,000 troops and not let anything that shouldn't get here come into our borders, either from Canada or from Mexico, and they wouldn't let anything through the ports. They would be monitoring the ports like they monitor you at the airport. And you know what? It was a little bit ago when they implemented a new policy. I think it was because of what happened in an attack in London. And so let me give you an example how I don't believe that by having open borders here and by having 250,000 troops in Iraq that's making me safer in Portland, Oregon. And but they're trying to make me think they're making me safer by, you know, airport security and other things that they're doing to monitor our email and monitor our conversations that we do, you know, invasion of privacy and these other things. Well, in the past year, I was going through the airport and I wasn't aware of the new policy that you're not allowed to take more than 3 ounces to carry on with you of something of a liquid. And so I had in my carry-on 6 ounces of toothpaste. And so they went to the scanner, and they called me over there, and they said, oh, do you mind if we look through? Okay, we'll look through. They poured it out, and they poured out the 6 ounces of toothpaste. And so you know what? They were able to be 100% sure that that was toothpaste. They could look at it. They could, you know, open it up, and they could squeeze it and be 100% sure that was toothpaste. But even though they were 100% sure that was toothpaste, they told me I'm not allowed to take it in the plane. And by not allowing me to take that toothpaste on the plane, somehow I was supposed to think it was going to make me safer. Now, the other thing that they do, you're not allowed to take liquids on. So if you take a bottled water on your carry-on and they see it, no, you're not allowed to take bottled water onto the plane because, you know, that's a security threat to the plane. So if I take it through the screening and that bottled water, they're going to say, no, you can't do it. They'll throw it away. But on the other side of the screening, there's a vendor selling bottled water that says, buy this.
You can take it on the plane. It's safe. And so are they doing that to make me safe? No, they're doing that to make money. Because they want to sell you bottled water. Next is the marriage of Zeus in Greek mythology. In Greek mythology, Zeus, the god of all gods, in Greek mythology, married Europa. And it's from Europa that the continent of Europe is named. Europe from Europa. And Europa, Zeus is described as a beast. And Europa eased her fears regarding him, and she climbed upon him. She rode the beast. That's what the book of Revelation, chapter 17, describes the imagery of. And here are some pictures that were taken from ancient civilizations of a woman riding a beast. The woman is Europa. And so what do we have when we talk about when the stocks go up? We have a bull market. That is Zeus terminology. Here in 1984, I have a European Parliament stamp and of a British stamp, 1984. And look what it is. It's a woman riding a beast. Do you think those who put out the stamp knew what that imagery meant? Of course they did. They're making a statement that we are rebuilding the Tower of Babel. Don't believe it? Well, here is an artist's rendition of the Tower of Babel. The picture, the artist made this in 1563. The artist is Peter Bruegel. Well, this is the present European Parliament building in Strasbourg, France. You see, they physically built it exactly as the artist's rendition of the Tower of Babel. They're making a statement. We're building the Tower of Babel, and you know what, Yahweh? You ain't doing nothing about it this time. Well, I have news for them. He is. Antiochus decreed a new world order under Greek culture. And so, in 1 Maccabees 1:10, Antiochus wrote to his whole kingdom that they should be one people and everyone should leave his laws. Be one people and leave his laws. So all the heathen agreed. You know what they just did in Europe? They formed a European Union. You know what that meant? The individual countries in Europe had to leave their laws. Everyone should leave their laws so they'd be one people, a European Union. And you know what they're presently doing and working on now with the United States, Mexico, and Canada? That they should leave their laws so that they would be one people. Now, if there's going to be a merging, then the laws have to be similar. We have some Canadians here. Gay marriage is approved in Canada, is that right? Yeah, and so you want to know why in the courts of the United States they're ruling to accept gay marriage? It's because if they're going to merge the laws of the United States and Canada, and Canada's got it, then we got to have it too. So really there isn't no law against it. You want to know why the Hispanics that come up through Mexico, the Bush administration doesn't regard them as illegal citizens? Because they're already living in North America. They're not illegal. They're already in the designated place that they see. Because the Greeks is going to tell the people, we all should be one and leave his laws. You see, how they're trying to frame the world is exactly how Antiochus did historically, but we don't know history well enough. We should know this. This is the book of Daniel. But we don't know this well enough to know that they're repeating what they did before. They know it. And so the king sent letters by the messengers unto Jerusalem and the city Judea that they should follow these customs. And in doing so, they wanted to do away with alternative religious worship. And so the temple and its services and its ways was a distinct, unique way of worship that wasn't according to unifying Greek law, and everyone has the one law about how to do things. And so they tried to do away with it. They forbid burnt offerings and sacrifice and drink offerings in the temple, and they profaned the Sabbaths and festival days, and they sacrificed swine's flesh and unclean beasts. 1 Maccabees 1:49, for the purpose that they may forget the Torah and change the ordinances. And so the kings sent letters that this should be followed, and that whoever would not do it should die. That which happened before will happen again. Do you know that if you have a credit card, it has an expiration date? Well, if you got good credit, why do they have to say, here's a new card? Why is there an expiration date? Because there's coming a day when they're going to implement new policies for that card, and you won't be able to get your card renewed unless you agree to the policies. And you know what that policy is going to be? One world government. Will you agree to be a good one world government citizen, or are you with those, like these outlaws, rebellious, those ones over there in Zion that's trying to take peace from the Middle East when we're trying to make peace? Which one are you? And if we know that you identify with that, if we got evidence that you identify with that, we're not renewing your credit card. You can't buy or sell. And furthermore, we could come after you and punish you for committing hate crimes against humanity, that whoever would not do according to the commandment of the king, he should die. And so I want to go slowly over what I just read to you, what Maccabees and ultimately Daniel refers to as the evil decrees of Antiochus. The evil decrees of Antiochus, who is a type of the Antichrist. Antiochus said, don't follow Torah, don't circumcise your children, don't celebrate the Sabbath, don't keep the festivals, there will not be sacrifices in the temple, and you can eat pig. Those are listed as the evil decrees of Antiochus. Do you realize that same list is what mainstream Christianity regards as the teachings of Paul and the way you express your faith in Messiah? How did the evil decrees of Antiochus be regarded as and accepted as the way you express your faith in Messiah? And we're going to defend it. If you're going to try to make us keep the law and circumcise and keep Sabbath and festivals and eat right, I'm going to bring the book of Galatians after you. And so, you see, the enemy wasn't successful legislating it back then, so he tried to implement it in a different form, in a different way, so that it would be acceptable to the religious masses who formally rebelled against it. And how do we understand this method of the enemy? Brad taught you the principle. It's the wheat and the tares. You know, the enemy tries to bring in the tares in. And so, anti-Torah is the spirit of anti-Christ. You know, we're thinking about a person, an anti-Christ person. And now there's new thoughts about, you know, somehow the Antichrist isn't even associated with faith in Yahweh and keeping His commandments. You know, apostate Israel is regarded as judged by Yahweh for departing from Torah. And so, if Messiah is the Messiah of Israel, the anti-Messiah has to be the proclaimed Messiah of apostate Israel. And what does apostate Israel do? Not follow Torah. So the man of sin is revealed. He sits in the temple of Elohim, showing himself that he is Elohim. You know, let me tell you how we interpret Scripture. Our body is the temple of the Ruach. It's not that temple. Our body is the temple. Okay, great. When I read temple, our body is the temple. But now when it says he goes into the temple, all of a sudden, that's not this temple. That's a literal temple out there. Well, there isn't a literal temple out there. It's been destroyed. Oh, it'll be rebuilt. And so he goes in the temple showing himself that he is Elohim. And you know what? This is the temple. He goes into this temple and declares himself to be Elohim. Why? I'm not going to follow Torah. And so the spirit of not following Torah is already in the world. And so once again, this outlines for you the evil decrees of Antiochus, which we just listed. Now, there were the majority of Jews who accepted the Greek culture and the Greek ways, and those Jews who accepted it were known as Hellenistic Jews, Greek Hellenism. 1 Maccabees 1:11, in those days there went out of Israel wicked men who persuaded many, saying, let us make a covenant with the heathen. You know what the nation of Israel, the leaders of the nation of Israel are doing? Let us make a covenant, we call it a peace agreement, with the heathen, with the European Union, the United States, and Russia, and with the Palestinians. Let's make a covenant with them. Let's not, as a nation, follow Torah. You know, the leaders in Israel are not advocating that the nation of Israel follow Torah. They're saying, no, we got to be like the nations of the world. Let us make a covenant with the heathen. So the present leadership in Israel are acting like Hellenistic Jews, accepting the world's culture, the world's ways, Western ways, Greek Hellenism. Now, history tells me that when this gets imposed upon a people that want to keep Torah, that they'll rebel. That's what the Maccabees did. So Antiochus wrote the whole kingdom that they should be one people. And so many of the Israelites consented to his religion or this belief system. Now, it is from Greece that we get democracy. And in the Jewish Encyclopedia, democracy was coined in ancient Athens in the 5th century B.C. So let's look at the current government of Israel. It's influenced by Western values. It accepts Western culture, influenced by the United States and Hollywood. It's got a parliamentary system of government, a democracy, and it promotes secular humanism, and it wants to be like all the nations of the world. Actually, the present nation of Israel resembles a lot like the historical Northern Kingdom. Antiochus waged war against the Jews, Daniel 8:25. And through peace, he destroyed many. Now, I've only got 15 minutes, and so I got to cover this principle fast, and after I cover this principle, I got about 10 or 12 slides to end the message to bring this all together. What I'm painting to you so far is that from the dividing of the land of Israel, it brings judgment upon the nations. And that judgment is upon Babylon, which I showed you applies to the United States of America. Now I'm laying the groundwork for what's got to happen in Israel. And that historically, there was a try to impose Greek culture, and there were those Jews who wanted to accept that Greek culture. And so that's what's happening in Israel. The government of Israel is trying to impose to be like the nations of the world. Now historically, that resulted in a Maccabean rebellion. In the future, it will result here in a rebellion against the PLO state, which the Bible calls the state of Zion. Now let me show you the significance of a Palestinian peace agreement based upon UN resolutions. First of all, I got to quickly give you a background. The modern state of Israel, the father of the modern state of Israel is known as Theodor Herzl, and he grew up in with a somewhat of a religious background, but he was basically secular in his adult life, and he witnessed in France things committed against the Jewish people, which he became frustrated about, and he said, you know what, the nations are never going to treat us the way they should. We need to establish a national homeland. And so the founding of the modern state of Israel can now be regarded as a secular Zionist movement. And that which is coming is a biblical Zionist movement. And so after Herzl's death, the new leader of Zionism became Chaim Weizmann. And through his efforts in World War I, he was a chemist, he helped Britain in the war effort against Germany. And so, because of helping Britain win, he petitioned the British government to help to create a Jewish homeland for the Jews, and this became known as the Balfour Declaration, November the 7th, 1917, which became known as the British Mandate. And it's from the British Mandate that Jordan was created, because the Arabs protested, no, you can't give all this land to the Jews, and so there was a compromise. Land was given for peace. And that first land that was given for peace is Jordan. But ultimately, because of the fight, the British gave up on the situation and said, we're giving this over to the UN. And so the UN voted on November the 29th, 1947, to divide the land, creating a Arab state, a Jewish state, and making Jerusalem an international city. And the British mandate ended on May the 14th, 1948, over the area. That is the day that Israel declared independence, at the end of the British mandate. And the Arabs said, no, we're not going to give a Jewish state. We're going to take it all. And so, you know, we're going to overwhelm the Jews. They're not organized. They don't have an army. We're going to be able to defeat them easy. So all the Arabs that got home, don't get involved in the crossfire of the war. They'll leave your homes. And when we win, you come back to your homes. That is what Arafat and Abbas is calling the refugees. The ones who left their homes in 1948. Probably not even living now. And so there was a UN resolution to make Jerusalem an international city. It's UN Resolution 181. You know, I believe it was in Canada, if I got my facts right. Yeah, I think it was in Canada that a rabbi and his son made a petition that on his passport it would say Jerusalem, Israel. And there was a ruling saying, no, Jerusalem. Why was that ruling, no, it's not Jerusalem, Israel? Because it is in violation of UN Resolution 181, which says Jerusalem's an international city. And the world planners ultimately want to make Jerusalem an international city, so they're not going to make a ruling until then to change it. That's why in 1996, the Congress passed that the United States would move its embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, and they haven't moved it yet, because it's to be an international city. So there was a 1949 armistice map of Israel, and then we have the 56 and 67 wars. And it's from these wars that Israel obtained the Sinai, the Gaza, the West Bank, and the Golan. And this became regarded as occupied territories. And so Israel began a process to give back these territories that they won in the 67 and 73 wars. And the Sinai was given to Egypt in the 1979 peace agreement. And now there's negotiation to make Gaza and the West Bank a Palestinian state, which, by the way, Gaza was under Egyptian control. The West Bank was under Jordanian rule. So it would make sense if Egypt says, give us the Gaza. It would make sense if Jordan says, give us the West Bank. But they're giving it to an entity that didn't even exist, that didn't even have a country, a made-up entity called the PLO that was formed to take back Israel. The name means To liberate Palestine. So this became the area of controversy to this day. Following the 67 war, UN Resolution 242 was passed. And this resolution, here it is, it says, peace with security is the resolution. And UN Resolution 338 was passed following the 73 war, and it says Israel must cease from fighting, the war must end, and we need to implement UN Resolution 242. We have the Israel-Egypt Peace Treaty of 1979, and in the preamble, here's the preamble of the peace treaty, it says that this peace agreement will be based upon UN Resolutions 242 and 338. We have a letter of Yasser Arafat to Yitzhak Rabin, 1993, where Yasser Arafat says that the PLO recognizes the right of the state of Israel to exist in peace and security, and the PLO accepts UN Resolution 242 and 338. That's now a part of the quartet demands that's on Hamas. So, because Arafat wrote a letter and said, we accept the UN resolutions, and we accept Israel's right to exist, when Mahmoud Abbas took over for him, that's why he's a good guy. That's why he's a moderate. You know who a good guy is? Anyone who wants to accept UN resolutions. You know who a bad guy is? Someone who doesn't. So you know Mahmoud Abbas denies the Holocaust? You know the faction of Mahmoud Abbas, the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade and those under Fatah, has killed more Jews than Hamas? Why are they the good guys and why are they the moderates? The answer is simple. Because they accept UN Resolution 242 and Hamas doesn't. And so if you want to be a part of the world community or accept being a part of the world community, you're a good guy. And so as a result, Israel recognizes the PLO, and Prime Minister Rabin writes a letter to Arafat and says, I recognize you as the leader of the PLO. And by the way, their agreement was September the 13th, 1993. That happened to be the Feast of Trumpets that year. There was a scheduled meeting Bush is proposing in September of this year. What if it's on September the 13th? I don't know whether it is or not. We'll find out. But if it is, you know what September the 13th is this year? The Feast of Trumpets. And so Oslo was based upon UN Resolution 242 and 338. Israel signed a peace treaty with Jordan in 1994, and it's based upon UN Resolution 242 and 338. Then we have UN Resolution 1397 on March the 12th, 2002. And this UN resolution says that there will be two states, Israel and Palestine, living side by side with peace and security. And this is currently what they're saying they're negotiating on and having a meeting about this September, which is the what they call the Saudi Peace Initiative of March the 28th, 2002, which says Israel must return to the pre-67 borders and they will be recognized by the Arab state. And then in 2003, Bush came up with the roadmap, which is the steps to create that PLO state. Now I have about 12 slides. If you can give me, I still have about 8 minutes, but I may need a few more minutes than that, but I only have about 10 or 12 slides left. And so why did I point out the UN resolutions based upon UN, the peace process based upon UN Resolutions 242, 338, and 1397. The answer is this. UN resolutions are regarded as world law. Therefore, the creation of a Palestinian state is world law. If you oppose a PLO state, you're opposing world law. And if you oppose world law, you're a criminal. So if you want to believe the Bible, if you want to believe the covenant made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, world law says you're a criminal. That's why the book of Revelation says they come and wear down and hunt down the saints of the Most High. That's why you'll need signs and wonders and miracles to protect you, because they find out that you believe in the covenant that was made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, you're fair game. You're a criminal. And it doesn't matter where you are out in the earth, they can come get you, because this is a this UN resolution is something that applies to the earth. And so, you realize the existence of the United States is not world law, but the existence of a terrorist state will be world law. You know, after 9/11, Bush says, if you're not for us, you're against us. If you safeguard a terrorist, you know, we regard you as a terrorist. We're against all the terrorist nations. But this guy that's fighting a war against terrorism, that's sending 250,000 troops to Iraq and not patrolling our borders or our ports and letting the free flow in here, is imposing upon Israel a state whose fathers are the fathers of modern terrorism. A Holocaust denier. And you know, Yahweh can tolerate a lot, but this, I think, He's got to get what I call the Popeye mentality. Over that, I have, as long as I can stands, and I can't stands a bit more. And he's got to grab out his spinach and fight for Zion. So here, the prophecy is that the sons of Zion will oppose the sons of Greece. And so there is going to be a rebellion against the PLO state by religious Jews who believe in the covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And they, because they're fighting literally against the world, against all odds, they're going to know, and they do know, that they have evangelical Christians who support them. And so because of their desperate situation, they're going to say, you know, if you're willing to come and stand with us and die with us, like Ruth, your people are my people, your Elohim is my Elohim, where you go, I will die with you if I have to. If they said, you know, if you're willing to do that, we'll discuss who the Messiah is later. Come. And that is the process that Ephraim and Judah gets joined together, and through that process, Messiah reveals himself to his people. Now, we're told that Zion is a nation born in a day. Stay with me now. I only got about 10 more slides. And then I'm going to finish up by explaining to you the rule of 144,000, and I'm done, okay? So Zion is a nation born in a day. Isaiah 66:8. Shall a nation be born at once? For as soon as Zion travailed, she brought forth her children. Zion is travailing. When do you travail? During the tribulation. So Zion travails during the tribulation, and during the tribulation, she brings forth her children. Who's her children? Ephraim and Judah. And it says, when you see this, when you see Zion travailing, when you see the creation of Zion, when you see it, your heart will rejoice, your bones will flourish, and the hand of Yahweh will be known to his servants and his indignation toward his enemies. That's what happened in Egypt. He distinguished between Goshen and Egypt. When that happens, then he's got to make a distinction. But, you know, so far he's not making much of a distinction between those who serve him and those who not. As a matter of fact, those who try to serve him get persecuted. You know, you're the radical right. You're the extremists. And so when you see this, Yahweh's got to fight for Zion. Now it says in Psalm 126:1, when Yahweh turned the captivity of Zion, we were like those that dream, then our mouth was filled with laughter. The word laughter there is Isaac. So the returning of the captivity of Zion is likened unto Isaac. The birth of Isaac in the Torah is a prophecy of the birth of Zion. And you know, when Isaac was told that you would have a son in your old age, she laughed. And so the redemption of Zion is like laughter. Oh, you mean Yahweh's got to gather y'all from the four corners of the earth? Yeah, right. But when was Isaac born? At the set time. The word in Hebrew is moed. It means a festival. All the rabbis agree that Isaac was born at Passover. When is Zion going to be born? At Passover. Why Passover? Because that's the festival of redemption. And so it says that Zion will come with joy and singing. Isaac means laughter. And the ransom of Yahweh will come to Zion with songs and joy and gladness. Now we get to Revelation chapter 12. Revelation chapter 12, there's two signs that are given. And from these two signs, it says that there's 3.5 years. Revelation 12, 1,260 days. Revelation 13, 42 months. They're both 3.5 years. Now, what I'd like to show you is Isaiah 66:8. For as soon as Zion travailed, Zion is the Strong's number 6726. And in the Strong's, it says it's the same as 6725, which is Zion. Now, Zion and Zion have the exact same Hebrew letters. The Zadi, the Yod, the Vav, and the Nun. Exact letters. The only difference is the vowels. But in the biblical text, there aren't any vowels. If you read a newspaper in Israel, there aren't any vowels. So when you're reading through and those four letters appear, how do you know whether it means Zion or Zion? Context. But what is the meaning of Zion? Remember Brad said that there's a parent and all the everything related to it is associated in Hebrew? Same letters. So So what does Ziyu mean? It means a sign, a signpost, a monument, a marker. So Zion can mean a sign. Zion can mean a sign. When it says the Jews require a sign, I could read it in Hebrew, the Jews require Zion. So here, in Jeremiah 31, Rachel is weeping for her children. And specifically, it's referring to Ephraim, is Ephraim my dear son. And Rachel is being told, quit weeping, because your children will come to their own border. Your children will come to their own border. And it refers to Ephraim coming to his own border. When's he got to come to his own border? Everyone asks me, okay, how's this got to happen? When's it got to happen? What do I do? It says, set you up. The King James says waymarks, but the Hebrew is Zion, which is the same letters as Zion. It should be rendered in context, set you up Zion. When does Ephraim return to his border? When is it time for you and I to return to the land? When you see Zion, right? Isaiah 66. When you see this, set you up Zion. Zion is the sign. So we're given 3.5 years to return to the land. Now in Micah chapter 5 verse 2, it talks about Messiah being born in Bethlehem Ephratah. And then in Micah chapter 5 verse 3, it says, He will give them up. If you study this, it means giving them up means He hides His face. He's not fully revealing Himself to His people. The Messiah will give them up, or not fully reveal Himself to His people, until the time that she which travails is brought forth, that Zion. He will give them up until Zion is born. Then, once Zion is born, then the remnant of His brethren will return to the children of Israel. Messiah will be still hiding His face until Zion's born. He quits hiding His face. He shows the difference between those who serve Him and those who don't. And once Zion is born, that's when the two houses come together. The remnant of His brethren will return to the children of Israel. Now, in Revelation 12, verse 1, there appeared a great sign in heaven. I can read that. There appeared a great Zion in heaven. So the two signs of Revelation 12 is Zion, and the other is the seven heads and ten horns, whatever how it's phrased. It's the beast and one world government. They both come into the world at the same time. The Zion comes about through a rebellion against the PLO state. One world government comes about through an attack and a collapse of the American economy, and they reorganize into one world government. And so this great sign is described this way. The sun and the moon's under her feet, and she has a crown. What do you do with the crown? You rule and reign with 12 stars. 12 stars to 12 tribes of Israel. And she was travailing in birth and pain to be delivered. This sign is born during the tribulation, pain to be delivered. Now the sun and the moon under her feet is ultimately, biblical Zion will defeat her enemies, which is Islam, the moon, and the sun, which is Greco-Roman Christianity. It's the end of Greco-Roman Christianity. No more Easter, no more Christmas, no more Sunday. The days of Christmas, Easter, and Sunday is just got a few years to go, that won't be done that way anymore. Now, what's the biblical state of Zion? It's the unification of the people, Ephraim and Judah, and the land, the Abrahamic covenant, wanting to follow Torah, setting up the Torah government, following the Messiah. The Messiah is glorified through these events, through the ingathering of the exiles. Isaiah 35:2. You will see the glory of Yahweh. What is seeing the glory of Yahweh? You'll see the glory of Yahweh, and the ransom of Yahweh will come to Zion. You will see the glory of Yahweh, and the ransom of Yahweh will come to Zion. When does Messiah get glorified? When the exiles return to the land. And Ezekiel 39, I will set my glory among the heathen, now will I bring again the captivity of Jacob. Ezekiel 39 is Gog and Magog. After you see the invasion of troops upon the mountains of Israel, in the defeat of them, that is, now will I bring again the captivity of Zion. So, what events are associated with bringing the captivity of Zion? Gog Magog in the declaration of the state of Zion. Psalm 102:13, you will arise and have mercy upon Zion. when Yahweh builds up Zion, He will appear in His glory. When Zion gets created and the two houses of Israel come together, Messiah comes in His glory. And that's why Messiah prayed that they may be one. Who's He praying that they would be one? The two houses. And when they are one, look what He prays. The world will know that You sent Me. When the two houses of Israel are one, the world will know that You sent Me. Why? Because I deliver them in signs and wonders and miracles, and I keep the nations. I show a difference between those who serve Me and those who don't. And the last thing I want to share with you is the 144,000, and I'm done. This shouldn't take very long. It's the rule of 144,000. It's the rule of 144,000 to bring the exiles back to the land. Revelation 7 talks about the 144,000. Now, in Leviticus chapter 23, it says, you are to keep the Feast of Tabernacles to remember that you're coming out of Egypt. You to keep the Feast of Tabernacles to remember you're coming out of Egypt. Remember, this is likened unto coming out of Egypt. So in Revelation chapter 7, in verse 9, it says, I saw a great multitude, which no man could number, of all nations. Tabernacles is called the Feast of All Nations. And the end of verse 9, they're waving palm branches. That's tabernacles. And they're saying, salvation to our Elohim, which sits on the throne. At tabernacles, there was a ceremony in the temple where the people said, Hosanna, save now! Hosanna, save now! So this is tabernacle talk. So the 144,000 is associated with tabernacles. And then that question is asked, Revelation chapter 7, verse 13. One of the elders said, who are these which are arrayed in white robes and where did they come from? Who are these that are arrayed in white robes and where they come from? Sir, you know, they came out of great tribulation the last 3.5 years. And here's how they're described. Verse 16. They will hunger no more, they will thirst no more, neither shall the sun light upon them, nor any heat. For the Lamb which is in the midst of the throne shall feed them, and He will lead them to fountains of living waters. Revelation 7 verse 16 is a quote of Isaiah 49 verse 10. If you look at the context of Isaiah 49 verse 10, Isaiah chapter 49... I'll go there. Isaiah chapter 49 and verse 6. It says, I'm going to raise up the tribes of Jacob and restore the preserved of Israel. In verse 9 it says that you may say to the prisoners, go forth. That's the exiles of Israel. So the exiles are going forth, they're raising up the tribes of Israel, and now it's the quote in verse 10. That's the context. Raising up the tribes of Israel, saying to the prisoners, go forth. Isaiah 49:10, they will not hunger nor thirst, neither shall the heat nor sun smite them, for He that has mercy shall lead them, even by springs of water shall He guide them. Who are these that came out of great tribulation? That verse is the answer. It's the exiles of Israel. Why will they hunger and thirst no more? Because remember, when you broke the covenant, I'm going to send you in the nations, you will be hungry and thirsty. Why will the sun not smite upon them? Because in exile, they got smitten by sun worship. Sunday, Christmas, the halo of Yeshua, that the pictures, how He's pictured, they will, and He'll be led by fountains of living waters. That is Messiah, His Spirit, and His Torah. And it says He will wipe away all tears from their eyes, is how the last verse ends. The tears is the exile. Wiping away the tears is no more exile. So there you have it. There's the picture. I'm done. The picture is a rebellion from a PLO state, judgment of the nations, and from that Zionist state, there's 3.5 years left. And the beginning of that process is Messiah reveals Himself to His people in the world. And that 3.5 years is designated to return to the land. You're led by the 144,000. If you would like to have these slides, I got a DVD out at the marketplace, Hebraic Bible Prophecy. That, along with my Two Houses book, is $40. Thank you for your time and attention. I pray it's been a blessing.